You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and joining you after a weekend in professional cycling when Tadej Pogacar cruised past Roger de Vlaeminck's career total of 11 monuments without yet taking aim at the Gypsy's most monumental achievement. Not his four Paris-Roubaix titles, but his second place in the 2005 World Wife Carrying Championship. My name's Daniel Freeman. I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we will look back at how the Slovenian conquered Flanders for a third time, wonder how he might obtain his first Roubaix cobble, and also opine on the wisdom of pissing off the crusty old print media by announcing you're riding the Ronda on April Fool's Day. Joining me to do that today is the certainly not crusty or old, but definitely PR savvy and suave, Brian Nygaard.
Thank you, Daniel. And thank you for that. I don't know, I smelled a compliment in there. Thank you.
Also joining us.
Here we go. Crusty and old.
No. And also joining us is the Aero Bullet of not Watford. The Aero Bullet, because Remco Evenepoel has a new nickname, which we'll discover in due course.
Hello. Hello, Brian. Nice to see you. Good to see you, Daniel, again.
Incidentally, the World Wife Carrying Championship 2005. Of course, Roger de Vlaeminck finished second in that. It wasn't his wife. We've talked about this on numerous occasions before. It took place in Finland. And there was no sort of reference intended to the sort of, it's not a piggyback. What is it when you put someone on your handlebars with Tadej Pogacar and Pauline Ferrand-Prevot? Well, it was no reference to that, but no news as yet on Pogacar taking aim at that particular competition, which will be of great relief to Roger de Vlaeminck. One of his achievements at least remains unchallenged. Chaps, we had a fantastic, well, very entertaining weekend, women's race, men's race. We've got another fantastic weekend, Paris-Roubaix, coming up. As discussed, we'll look back a little bit at Flanders, some of the issues that arose from Flanders, and we'll also look forward to the Hell of the North on Sunday, isn't it? But first, Lionel, there are a couple of other races that have finished, that have concluded, that we should also mention that happened at the weekend. I don't think we mentioned them in Arrivé on Sunday evening. One was the GP Miguel Indurain, which was won by Basque rider Jon Izagirre in pretty fantastic fashion. A really sort of sentimental victory. Jon Izagirre, of course, a Basque rider, he's won that race before. And the NXT Classic was won by Thibaut Del Grosso, who is a rider that people will certainly expect to star in the Cobble Classics in future years. Very promising young Dutch rider, cyclocross rider for Alpecin Premier Tech. But, chaps, also in the Basque Country, Itzulia, the Tour of the Basque Country, has commenced. Fantastic field. We're looking forward to this. I will be going there tomorrow, but already yesterday, in fantastic weather in Bilbao, very warm in the Basque Country at the moment, we had the opening time trial, hilly time trial. Sort of traditional for the Basque Country to have a hilly time trial at some point in the week, and kicked off with one yesterday in Bilbao. 13.8 kilometers, won by the chosen one himself, Paul Seixas, by a very emphatic margin of 23 seconds of his compatriot, Kevin Vauquelin. Did you see any of that, chaps?
Yes. The average speed, I mean, Paul Seixas was over a kilometer an hour faster than Kevin Vauquelin. Quite, you know, you say 23 seconds over 17 and a bit minutes, but that tells one story. But over a kilometer an hour average faster is significant. And yeah, I think it sets up a great week of racing. And well, the Seixas hype train is, it's going to be scheduling a stop in Barcelona for the start of the Tour de France if this carries on, surely.
And it also gives a really interesting trajectory for how he's timed his shape towards the Ardennes, and thinking about how fresh Pogacar will be coming out of the first part of the classics. How will those two clash? The climbing legs of Seixas coming out of the Basque Country, and the potential tired legs of Pogacar finishing the cobbles going into the islands. Very curious about that.
Yeah, it was a pretty extraordinary performance. A lot of people had him down as the favourite. It felt almost premature to me to have six us down in a race like the Basque Country. If you send, he's not a neo pro, but he's a second year pro and he's still a teenager. Usually that's a real sort of baptism of fire for a young rider, and they're doing well to sort of finish it or figure in any way whatsoever. And for people to already be anointing him as the favourite, particularly with the route of the Tour of the Basque Country this year, I won't go into detail, but it's incredibly hilly. You've got long climbs today. They've got a pretty long climb, a 10-kilometer climb, I think. And then you've got the sort of the famous climb, Arate, Krabbelin, later in the week. A lot of very steep climbs at the end of stages. And we've already discussed this before, that Sexas, if anything, among his, well, in his sort of repertoire of abilities, we suspect that he's going to be best at long climbs. And in environments like the one you alluded to a minute ago, Lionel, the Tour of France, Tour of France, they call it the Tour de France. Did you know that in France? We shall see. We shall see. I think it's going to be interesting from that point of view, just to see how good he is on those explosive climbs. Yesterday, we had a couple of the other sort of pre-race, well, the bill-topping riders, some pre-race favourites in some people's eyes. Isaac del Toro, Juan Ayuso, not really distinguishing themselves. Del Toro lost 51 seconds, finished 13th. Ayuso was even further down, 30.
1 minute 16.
Yeah, 1 minute 16. We're not really sure what happened there. Of course, he had that crash in Paris a couple of weeks ago, but we haven't heard too much about him being, well, he wouldn't be racing the Tour of the Basque Country if he was still suffering in any significant way, but maybe his training's been disrupted. But there are others as well who are very much preparing the Ardennes Classics, the likes of Skelmoser, Ben Healy as well is another one. Primoz Roglic, he was fourth yesterday, did what I imagine felt like a pretty good ride, but lost 28 seconds to Sexas. Of course, Roglic is he's accustomed to winning hilly time trials in the Basque Country. He's done it before, but Sexas yesterday showed him who was boss. So pretty mouth-watering race in store over the next few days.
Yeah, it's interesting, this one, isn't it? Because there's all of these sort of competing objectives further down the line. So, as you say, riders who are targeting the Ardennes Classics, and by that we're really referring to Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and we kind of roll Amstel Gold into that, even though it's not in the Ardennes. Ilan Van Wilder of Soudal Quickstep was pretty good, wasn't he? Fifth place. He'll be looking ahead to those races. And as you mentioned, Roglic, Daniel, the Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe duo, we've been accustomed to seeing how Lipovits and Evenepoel dovetail together. Well, this week we'll see how Lipovits and Roglic dovetail together. I mean, Lipovits is putting together a pretty solid campaign already, isn't he? And it's going to be really interesting to see what sort of shape he's in at the Tour de France and what that pecking order is like with Remco Evenepoel, who now, of course, is a cobbled classic specialist. So, I mean, do we know anything about cycling at the moment?
No, I like that right now. Isn't it great not to necessarily be able to predict everything? We talked about that the last time, that it's gotten boring, didn't we, Lionel?
Well, I mean, on the TNT television coverage, they had Alberto Contador reconning the Alba Quadamont, and I just thought, no, this is all wrong. This is all wrong.
Well, Dan, I sent you a video of it was a commercial for a French cycling brand, and they had used Laurent Jalabert to promote Paris-Roubaix. And I was like, it's all gone wrong now. There's like nothing, there's no... All the pillars of what I know about cycling have just crumbled.
Right, I can remember doing Laurent Jalabert doing one thing north of about Toulouse in the whole of his career, and that was a terrible crash in Almontiel in the Tour de France, which sort of changed his destiny as a rider. Thereafter, he became a GC rider rather than a sprinter. But beyond that, in the Northern Classics, he rarely participated and certainly didn't really leave any significant mark.
Whatever next? Lance Armstrong coming out of retirement to ride Paris-Roubaix on Sunday. You heard it here first, the breaking news.
There you go. More on Remco in part two.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Indeed Sponsored Jobs. If you're in charge of recruitment for your company, Indeed Sponsored Jobs is all you need to make that star signing to complete your lineup for the rest of the year and beyond. Because when you're trying to recruit somebody for your company, you want to sign the best possible person. It's a bit like building a cycling team, isn't it? You want the candidate with all the right skills, all the relevant experience, somebody who can deliver results as soon as they arrive in your organization. And indeed, sponsored jobs can help you do that. First of all, by making you stand out from the crowd, giving your job advert the prominence that it deserves, and that will help to attract the top quality candidates. So you can draw up a shortlist and then decide who you want to interview. More than 1.6 million companies worldwide use sponsored jobs by Indeed, and it really makes a difference because according to Indeed's data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed are 90% more likely to report a hire than non-sponsored jobs. And that's because you'll reach a wider pool of top quality candidates. So spend more time interviewing candidates who tick all your boxes. There's less stress, less time spent on the recruitment process, and better results with Indeed sponsored jobs. And because you listen to the Cycling Podcast, you can get a £100 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves. Just go to indeed.com/cycle. That's indeed.com/cycle. Tell them that you support the Cycling Podcast by saying you heard about Indeed on the show. Indeed.com/cycle. Terms and conditions apply. If you're hiring, do it the right way with Indeed.
We concluded our Arrivé, certainly the men's Arrivé, of course it was a women's Arrivé episode as well, looking back on Demi Vollering's victory on Sunday. But we concluded the men's episode with a cliffhanger. Would Tadej Pogacar, Remco, was it Remco Evenepoel as well? Would they end Sunday night in a Belgian jail? Because of course, there was this issue, this controversy about whether they had jumped a light, jumped a level crossing. And we had all sorts of threats from Belgian public prosecutors about hauling them in front of justice the next morning and throwing them in a cell. And it's now Tuesday. And as far as we know, Tadej Pogacar is back on the Côte d'Azur, maybe in exile, maybe, well, either in exile or on the run.
Yeah, they're at large.
Yeah. Actually, there was where the Rolling Stones went to, you know, Exile on Main Street. They went to the Côte d'Azur to record that album when they were actually sought after by the police, I believe, in the UK. So I think they actually went to Saint-Tropez.
I think a lot of criminals have escaped to the Côte d'Azur. It's not quite the Costa del Crime, that's somewhere else, but I think, yeah, it has a bit of a record for that. And maybe it's time for our weekly check-in with a man who I'm sure is intimately familiar with the Belgian train timetables, the palmarès, the roll of honour, the wiles of all of the, certainly the Belgian classics. And that is our good friend and faithful correspondent from the classics, formerly of Het Nieuwsblad, veteran journalist Hugo Corvitz.
Pay attention, freebie. As every year, I lost my voice on Sunday evening because of the party. I'm glad that I have it back by now. This Ronde van Vlaanderen was not only the monument with the most top riders at the start, but the Big Five also finished neatly first, second, third, fourth, and fifth. The Oude Quaremont and the Paterberg weighed the stars and ranked them neatly according to specific gravity. Everyone from the Big Five crossed the finish line alone and on the right place at that. All this after a quintessential Ronde van Vlaanderen with four seasons in one day. On the podium stood three world-class riders who, as pros, have claimed 16 world titles across all disciplines. Two for Tadej Pogačar, 10 for Mathieu van der Poel, and four for Remco Evenepoel. Remco Evenepoel, the name has been mentioned. I remember sending you a message last Monday in which I wrote that there was a very high chance he would make his debut in the Ronde van Vlaanderen. And many journalists didn't take kindly to that. But what does he care? And what did the outside world care? For 70 months now, I've been a retired journalist standing on the other side of the line. Well, the public was happy that Pinocchio was there. Pinocchio is his new nickname under the in-crowd journalist. Remco was cheered on just as fiercely as Wout van Aert. So fiercely, in fact, that on the first ascent of the Paterberg, he became overconfident by intimidating Pogačar. The score between MVDP and Pogačar in Eldenaarde is now 3-0. One thing has now become clear. Wout van Aert risks joining the ranks of Greg Van Avermaet and Freddy Martens, among others. Those are two other Flemings who never won the Ronde van Vlaanderen. So for Van Aert, only Paris-Roubaix remains, which suits his profile better. I myself saw the hell of the North with my own eyes the Monday after Milan-San Remo. I followed Lotte Kopecky's team as they worked pro time, who were out reconnoitering the cobbles. Due to a wet winter, the cobblestones are even worse condition than in other years. Ultimately, for the world champion, this is the very last obstacle on his way to 5 monuments in a row in one and the same season. Only that would be historic. Because, admit it, for Poggi, Liège-Bastogne-Liège and the Giro di Lombardia are like veni, vidi, vici.
Hugo has unveiled, never mind unveiling Remco's participation, revealing that Remco will be participating in the Tour of Flanders. Hugo has unveiled Remco's new nickname there, Pinocchio. Pinocchio. I would also suggest that Hugo, over the last couple of years he's been doing this for us, has presented a strong case for a new nickname for Tadej Pogačar, and that is Pogačar. Pogačar, I think it's better than my effort, the Slovenian. Anyway, chaps, and Brian, one of the reasons we summoned you today was that you, of course, have great expertise in the world of PR and cycling for many years. You were the press officer, PR manager, chief spin doctor for Team CSC, then Team Sky. Yeah, you did it briefly. And then later on for the team that was known variously as Green Edge, Mitchelton, and so on and so forth. So at the risk of lapsing into a discussion that might seem a little bit self-referential, because this is journalists talking about something that regarded journalists, and journalists got it in a bit of a froth about, and I've had that confirmed to me this morning, calling some of the colleagues who were at Remco's press conferences in, or his press conference in Flanders last week. We are going to discuss this issue a little bit because it does raise interesting questions, I think, and prompts interesting reflections on how the media is evolving, the media in cycling is evolving, and also how teams are evolving. And let's not forget, we've heard a lot in recent times about how cycling needs to change its business model, generate more revenue streams. And one of the things that's often talked about is storytelling. How do we better communicate what's going on in cycling to the outside world, the public? And do we need media, a medium through which to do that? So, Brian, first of all, when you saw this at a distance playing out last week, Remco and the team initially lying, and that was the word that Remco used himself, lying to the media for an extended period throughout this winter about whether he was going to do the Tour of Flanders. And then on April Fool's Day, coincidentally announcing that they'd been having us on this whole time, and indeed he was going to start. What do you make of it all?
It's a bit pathetic that they have to lie about it. I don't particularly like that, but it's a reflection of how they look at the media, I think, first of all, right? And it's also it's a reflection of a certain understanding of that the media is to them secondary, and it also means that they don't really see, as I do, that the media is really a way of talking to their audience, because they talk to their audience via social media, and social media loves the element of surprise. They love that things go viral, and that's all about the excitement. So that they can create the excitement and a piece of news, that's all they want. I think that the audiences that they really are interested in don't feel like they're being lied to. If the team and Remco and his entourage, or whatever, say that they lied to the media, their main audience, in their perception at least, they don't care that the media is being lied to. They just love a bit of news. They love a bit of, you know, viral action. There's another element to this, and also because of how it grew. Don't forget that in in Belgium in this period, and that's also why these things get somehow mixed up, cycling is at the front page of major newspapers, right? It's like a general election would be in the countries where you are and Lionel were born, you know, in Denmark and in the UK. It's the biggest news there is in this period. In these weeks, it's major news. So, for instance, if Patrick Lefebvre goes out and says Remco Evenepoel is lying, it's front page news. But that's in the traditional media sense. I think the audiences on social media don't really care if Patrick Lefebvre says Remco Evenepoel is lying or not. It's all about the gimmick. It's all about the explosion on social media. Traditional media, in my opinion, has no real value to them. Don't forget that they work for a team, Red Bull, which in itself is a media platform more than anything else. They sell carbonated water with whatever they put in it, sugar and something else. And they created a media platform around that. They have sports teams because of it, and they're their own editors. They have surfing competition, they have cliff diving, they have whatever else they have, and they control that completely. They know exactly which buttons to push. They could not care less about newspapers, radio stations, TV, and whatever. When they do something like this, they do it maybe not with a completely fully fledged strategy, but traditional media has absolutely zero interest to them, in my opinion.
Brian, should they care? Do they need to care? Because the journalists themselves and those who were lied to certainly care that they were lied to.
Of course, they should care, as anyone should care, because we live in a world right now where there is a very, very blurry line between truth, facts, and people who want to distort those and make sure that they can control things so the truth doesn't matter anymore. And sport is secondary to whatever else is going on right now, but we live in the post-factual part of the history of the world, right? So people who control social media also tend to control facts, and that's been the case for a very long time. But when you see now that the traditional media that's being held accountable to facts, and media that's actually you and I and other journalists alike, you know, we're in major trouble if we don't write facts, and we could potentially and should also lose our jobs if we don't work that way, right? And if we can't rely on sources, and if we post and write and file stories that are based on lies, we're in trouble, right? And if we, let's say, if we give an example, if you stop a rider like in your function at the finish line and talk to him, and he tells you a lie about another rider, and you present that lie to another rider, and he reacts to it, you create havoc, right? You have a whole different kind of story, especially if it was about something important, not necessarily about someone riding a race or not. So of course they should care, but they don't. They really don't. They care about the audience, and they don't consider us a medium for that audience. And that's a whole nother story, but it ties very well into the way the world works right now with traditional media and social media.
The first thing to say is that the news of Remco Evenepoel riding the Tour Flanders is for Remco Evenepoel and the team to break, right? It's for them. They're entitled to make their decision. They're entitled to pick their team whenever they want. They're entitled to try and gain, even if it was a sporting competitive advantage, in keeping back that information. That where it becomes tricky is if they outright say, no, he's not riding, in order to just deceive the media, or just to hold back the announcement so they can announce it on their own terms. I think they're straying there into slightly grey areas. I think they're also overestimating their own importance and reach compared to the collective importance and reach of the mainstream media. And the great irony is that the whole reveal sort of doesn't go anywhere if the mainstream media were not to react, right? Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe have got 626,000 followers on Instagram. They've got 157,000 followers on Twitter. Remco Evenepoel's got 1 million followers on Instagram. You know, that they're, in the grand scheme of things, small numbers, right? And so then it's not like they're announcing David Beckham joining Real Madrid. It's a relatively niche sport sports announcement. It's a team selection issue, right?
Yeah. And but it's a big team, one in cycling, though, Lionel.
It is a big one in cycling. But what were they trying to do? If they were trying to generate buzz, anticipation, excitement, making that announcement sooner and having a longer tail and a bigger build-up would probably have led to a greater sense of anticipation. My sense of it is that the win for them is that they kept it secret and that the journalists didn't find out and it didn't get broken as a story by Het Nieuwsblad or whoever. And I think that's slightly the wrong way around.
It could also be that they had doubts until the very last minute. They wanted to see how he fared in Catalonia.
Yeah, I think that was the case. And the way they, so obviously he announced it himself on his own YouTube channel, and Lionel talked about numbers there. That video I looked this morning has currently got 280,000 views, so decent number. Probably,
but also,
for
can I just say that strategically, from my perspective, they could always be sure that the news of him riding it, right, that nugget of very sexy cycling piece of news would always outshine that he had lied about it, right? The headline would never be Evenepoel lied about participation, but now he does it. The headline would always be Remco rides Flanders. So the secondary that he lied about it before is something that you and I can discuss now from a, you know, from whichever perspective that we find relevant, but it would always outshine that he lied about it. It's that's all in the past now. But it's pretty fundamental and it is significant, because just to reiterate, how can we ever trust? I generally think we can trust what people tell us, but it just means that lying has just become something that you do at your own leisure, right? When you feel like it's convenient, right? And it's also because cycling has a story with lying, right? Cycling there's something about lying in cycling that just for journalists and audiences that go a couple of decades back in cycling, that they feel a little bit miffed about, and rightfully so.
Where do you draw the line? I mean, it's, you know, if it was a case of a rider lying about where they've been training, I mean, there's a very significant precedent with Michael Rasmussen and the whereabouts scandal, the fact that he said he was training in Mexico when he wasn't, he was actually in Italy. And, you know, that was a major scandal. I'm not in any way comparing these two things, but you're absolutely right, Brian. There's the cycling's got an iffy enough relationship with the truth in the not so distant past to make this slightly uncomfortable. Daniel, you mentioned the figures there for Remco's YouTube video. I mean, that's broadly similar with the daily circulation of Het Nieuwsblad, the newspaper in the Flanders region of Belgium. I mean, like I say, in the grand scheme of things, these are small numbers. And in order to kind of fan the flames of anticipation and excitement and what have you, the teams, the sport, the riders, they need a network, an infrastructure of media, people to take interest. I mean, if they'd done it in collaboration with a broadcaster in Belgium, as we sometimes see on Sky Sports News here in the UK, a football club will share an in-house interview with the manager or a player, and there'll be a sort of scheduled release and what have you. I could sort of see the point of that, because then it does tick this box of kind of storytelling, promoting the sport, you know, giving everyone the chance to kind of build up to, wow, Remco is going to go head to head with Mathieu van der Poel and Tadej Pogacar in Flanders. It gives us all a chance to kind of build up that excitement, that anticipation. I think, you know, I kind of dug out the stats about the fact that Remco Evenepoel until Sunday was the only Belgian man to win the rainbow jersey in the World Road Race Championships who'd never actually lined up at the start of Flanders. I mean, that in itself is a big story in cycling.
If anything, it's actually a bit lazy, you know, because the one thing doesn't rule out the other, right? He could have done that and then say, oh, by the way, I have a press conference you couldn't invite everyone because it would have been, you know, havoc, but he could have invited 10, 15 media outlets for a press conference at the bar in under Old Quadramon, that, you know, and then posted his video on YouTube all the same.
But right? Isn't that the issue, Daniel, is that, you know, a mainstream media, a cycling mainstream media, which in itself is niche, is kind of being sidelined to a degree and being made to feel, I mean, that's maybe not the right, but this has to be a kind of two-way relationship.
When you talk about the sort of cycling's unfortunate history and heritage, as far as lying, deception is concerned, but there is also this perception, or this feeling among us particularly, that there has been over the years, over the decades, over the generations, there's a relationship of reciprocity between the press and the protagonists themselves, the teams themselves. And okay, we've seen this slowly be eroded over the years, and this is another discussion. Is this us just feeling slightly affronted because our realm feels as though it's been squeezed all the time by things like team YouTubes, podcasts, and so on and so forth? So that's one point. Yeah, this feeling that it's part of the sort of romance of the sport has been this reciprocity between journalists, the media, and riders. It's we no longer live in a world in a sport whereby journalists will routinely visit the riders when they're having massages. And we used to hear stories about how this was a sort of daily occurrence. You've got great pictures of people like Fausto Coppi on the massage bed and some of the great Italian journalists there talking to him, gathering their information that way. That no longer exists. But what does still routinely happen is that you go to races and you have conversations with team personnel, riders, managers, soigneurs, mechanics, and they will give you information and they will say, but please don't write that. Please don't divulge this piece of information. And by and large, we respect that. And if we don't respect that, we suffer the consequences. We are sort of marginalized. There is a feeling that that has been violated by this. And just on a sort of leaving to one side what this says about the future of the media and the sport, just on a very personal level, the journalists in Belgium in particular feel very affronted by this.
No, I mean, we've all seen the development because we, you know, the three of us still go to the occasional bike race. The number of journalists there, I mean, it's not even halved. It's a quarter at best, apart from the Tour de France, which is still busy in the press room and everything.
Little Trek, Brian, employ more press people. And most of them are former journalists. We know them. Than L'Équipe.
Yeah, that says a lot, right? It's not necessarily just something we should scorn Little Trek for, but because it's a result of a mechanism in the market that's a tendency everywhere, right? That people do not want to pay for journalism. People do not want to pay for quality media content. That's a fact that's beyond cycling or beyond sports in general, right? So it's not something that necessarily has to do with the social media teams of whichever sporting group you will have. I just think that the sad part of it is that it's fan media, really, what the teams do, right? And it's content that's edited to tell a certain story, that's biased, that doesn't give what a journalist that has, say, like the experience of Hugo of Kortowicz has, or someone that's followed the sport throughout generations and has a different perspective, and sometimes there is questions that should be asked, not necessarily questions about the past of cycling in a dodgy way, but questions that need perspective, life perspective even, and not perspective of someone who's 22-year-old and who knows how to handle a GoPro camera. Like, just real perspective.
And trust and confidence.
Yeah. Yeah.
That the interlocutor has your best interest as the reader, as the consumer at heart, and not the interest of their sponsor, their paymaster, above everything else.
It goes without saying. I really think there's no sound argument against the fact that should be disregarded and seen as relevant. And the one thing, the real concern for me is that the athletes don't get it. And they don't have to get it because no one tells them that it's not relevant to them, right? And if the choice is between their own recovery, time with a family or whatever next level of a PlayStation game, I'm sorry for being facetious, but why would they care? Why? If no one tells them, why would they care?
Well, the thing is, the athletes are there to try and win the races. Daniel, you made the point about storytelling and the sports kind of, it's one of these buzzwords, isn't it? We hear that the assumption is that cycling is such a fantastic sport that if only we could tell the story more effectively, suddenly tens of millions of people would become more interested in it. And without sort of debating the whys and wherefores of that, and first of all, making it very clear, you know, I love the sport of professional cycling. I love the quirks. I love the weirdness. I love the fact that, you know, that it still has that interaction between fans, media, and riders that other sports have kind of lost in the modern era. You can go and ask riders a question. The point is that team PR is there to promote the team and put out the message the team wants to put out. If that is a one-way relationship, then we're all really only hearing promotional material. No matter how good it is, we're only hearing the kind of uncritical. From the point of view of storytelling, what is the biggest story in cycling at the moment? It is Tadej Pogacar's dominance, the likelihood that he might win Paris-Roubaix for the first time, the possibility that he could win all five monuments in 1 year. It is the burning story. And the people we do not hear that story from, that we don't hear the reaction, or certainly not in the heat of the moment, but no one is kind of telling that story in a peloton-wide fashion if the main source of information is just coming from the teams. Now, take a real-world example that would be relevant to all of us as journalists. We're there at the end of the Tour of Flanders. We could go up to Mads Pedersen, who's just finished fifth. You know, his day has been hard. He's raced the best race he can possibly do, and he's finished behind. It's not that moment for a journalist to go up and necessarily ask the question, what's it like racing in the era of Pogacar? What, putting it into context, you can't do that while the mud's still kind of fresh on his face. But there's a kind of bit of a vacuum here. And while you've got an ecosystem in which all of the teams are interested in putting out their point of view, there is still space for the kind of aggregation, because media, it has not changed. Media is a pyramid, right, of interest from the public. You've got the fanatics, who are absolutely at the top of the pyramid, and they know everything, and they will be interested in the all 20 World Tour teams and loads of riders, and know loads about it. And then you kind of come down the pyramid, and as the base widens, at the bottom of the base, you've got people who will switch on the telly to watch the last hour of the Tour of Flanders or the last hour of Paris-Roubaix, and might go, wow, Remco's riding, you know, what's gone on there, you know. And I think what the sport fails to understand is that those links in that chain of interest have to be joined up if they're to have any chance to grow the base of the pyramid, and therefore make the top of the pyramid bigger as a result. You know, I mean, that's a bit of a broad assessment of like how the media and the sport infrastructure kind of used to work. There was much more sort of symbiosis between the two. The journalists were the storytellers, and the teams and the riders were the athletes. Now the teams and riders are trying to do the storytelling as well. And from my point of view as a journalist, you know, after a race, I get 15, 20 team emails telling me how they've all got on. You know, our team got sixth and ninth, and our team got fourth, and our team got 11th. Like, nobody's telling the complete story from the team side. They're only telling their own individual story. And like it or not, the public want the story. They don't want the individual story. So on any given day, Visma Elisabike might be the most important story, and they might attract a bit of interest there when they're on in the spotlight.
Has the public lost that, the ability to hierarchize? And I find myself, when we're thinking about this, and I found myself trying to sort of take myself out of my sort of own tunnel vision as a journalist and think about this and listen to what people like Hugo is saying. Hugo's been outside of the sort of journalist pen for 18 months, and he now can see it with a different perspective, and he says, look, the public don't care. And I found myself thinking, well, okay, a 20-year-old who's a 20-year-old fan, or 15-year-old fan who's following all of this, you know, in 20 years they'll be sort of waxing poetic about, oh, remember when he announced on YouTube, remember what YouTube was, and it will seem awfully romantic then. And you know, sometimes I do feel that we're blinkered. And what was, just to go back to what was the point I was going to make, have people maybe in their 20s, younger than us, have they lost the ability and the need, the compulsion to hierarchize now? And actually, if they're slightly interested in cycling, they open their social media and they get a whole load of news about cycling, and they're just going to click on Leonard Kemner, 15-minute interview with Leonard Kemner on Little Trek. You know, I'm not picking on Little Trek or aggrandizing them in any way, but let's say 15-minute interview, Leonard Trek, Little Trek. Whereas behind the next story is a fantastic summary written by someone like Alex Roos in L'Equipe, which brings everything together beautifully, ties every thread about what's going on in the sport, what's going on with Pogacar. Do they just click on the first thing and don't really care?
I'm pretty convinced they do. I don't think there's a convergence between, if you see a Venn diagram between those two, I don't think there are a lot of people who do that and then go on to read Alexander Rose's piece.
We're screwed, basically.
But, yeah, basically. I have a practical solution for this.
I don't think so.
I mean,
I think there's life in the old docks. Yeah.
No, I hope so. I mean, I'm not even the fingernail of what Alexander Rose is able to do on a keyboard. But I chronicle cycling, right? That's actually what pays the rent at this house. But chronicling things in written language, where you do your best to actually encompass what's happening in a race, be it Flanders, be it the stage of the tour, whatever, it's really important, I think, for the future generations. It's also important to keep written language alive about sports. There is something about that I'll never give up in believing the importance about that. That's how I came into the sport, and it's really something that I take very seriously. But one thing though, on now that we're talking about social media and the role that they have, and you said, Daniel, that Little Trek, or probably a lot of the other big teams, they employ more journalists than some of the traditional media, even endemic media. I think that the teams that are serious, right, and serious about how they handle media, the press officer cannot be the social media content producer. They really need to be separate roles. And the one who handles media is not the one who's walking around with a GoPro on a stick or handles Instagram, Twitter, or TikTok or whatever. Those are two completely separate things. It does not make sense that you have all these functions, because taking care of media, especially at the tour, or at races where it really matters, where there is big interest, and Paris-Roubaix is a very good example, especially if you have riders who perform there and there's a story to tell. That's really a job in itself. And I really don't think that some of those young people are equipped to do that. I think someone like a really senior in their 60s journalist, someone who's actually seen and know how it works, that they should fit really well into that job. And I'm definitely not suggesting myself. I'm totally done with that. But I think that those are really there's positions there. And what I find interesting is that a team who understands that is that Paul Sexas has now Decathlon have hired a former Equipe journalist, Dominique Sattel, to take care of the media for him, and that's a hire that's definitely not based on social media accumulation. It's a hire based on helping him dealing with the media and helping the media getting access to him. So kudos for that.
You made a point there, Daniel, about the sort of the hierarchy of media consumption, and have we lost something? I'm not necessarily sure we have, because it's kind of always been the case, hasn't it? And I try to look at cycling through the prism occasionally of my interest in other sports. You know, like I will watch, it's the Masters Golf this weekend. It's the best golf tournament of the year, but it's also the only one that I really pay attention to and watch. And I will get really into it. And, you know, in the past, I've been a golfer and, you know, I have sort of dipped my toe into watching some of the other tournaments. But at the end of the day, it's the Masters and the Ryder Cup and I'm usually at the Tour de France when the Open's on, but those major events are the ones that I'm interested in. And I'm kind of, you know, I'm aware of and interested in a sort of half dozen players, and then somebody new will come up. And the cycling equivalent golf fan who knows, you know, the 100th ranked player in the world will be like, well, surely you know you've been following this, haven't you? Well, I haven't, you know. And I think that the big misunderstanding of everyone working in their own individual sport, and I include ourselves in this, is that we assume that everyone has got the same knowledge and interest and understanding of like the tiers and layers of the sport. And actually the success of a sport in terms of its media profile, in terms of its ROI for sponsors, in terms of its marketability, is growing the base of the pyramid in order to strengthen and expand the top of it. And I think the problem with the sort of fleeting way that the teams and a lot of the established media treat subjects these days is that it's all about fleeting interactions rather than engagement. And if the aim is just to kind of fleetingly appeal to people, fantastic, probably job done. But what are they actually trying to do? They're trying to build and strengthen and deepen the connections between a sports watching public and their own particular sport, right? I just don't think that many of them have got the understanding of how those bonds get established in the first place, strengthened, deepened for the benefit of the sport as a whole. If you imagined, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, if there was one central kind of team-owned media platform, which was a website and a streaming service and all the videos and everything, and all the fans went to that one website, you would still have the situation of, why are Picnic Post NL not getting the same number of clicks as UAE Team Emirates or Visma Lisa Bike? And it would really show in a stark way the hierarchy of the teams. And really what they're all doing is they're all competing against one another for interest. And really, when your riders finish ninth, if this was a kind of an egalitarian media landscape where the story wins, really, when your riders finish ninth, you kind of settle into the background a bit and let the teams that have got the stories to tell, tell the story. And then you come in a few days later with your kind of sideways look at what's happened. And there would be some sort of editorialization of the sports narrative. But that is the bit that is missing. And as much as the teams may not want to accept it, that is what media professionals in television, print and, heaven forbid, podcasts do have some understanding of, whether it's Hugo in Belgium or, you know, Ciro in Italy.
I wanted to give a shout out to someone who was featured on the podcast before, Joe Laverick, who has been a rider, he's been a team manager, a journalist as well. And on his Substack recently, 8 days ago, he did a fantastic, a very, very substantial piece of work called The Peloton Economy. And in it, he revisited something which some listeners will remember called the RAFA Roadmap. And obviously people will be familiar with RAFA. And that was a sort of series of suggestions, proposals for how cycling can become more sustainable. And I think it was just 2019 that was released, and Joe wanted to review what was recommended and look at how much progress has been made. But there's a lot of talk in that. I recommend people read it. It's a very long read. I don't know how many words, maybe about 15,000 words, but it's a very long read, and there's a lot of talk in that about storytelling. And Joe and I got into a bit of a conversation afterwards, and he sort of said, well, what would you suggest? And I said, well, thankfully, Joe, it's not really my job. I was here when two men and their dog were watching the sport, and I'll probably be here somehow, if that's still the case, in 15 years. Lionel, you get the example of Pogacar and that being the biggest story in the sport and the sort of broad brushstroke story that the mainstream audience might be interested in. It might bring that. I think that's what teams feel will move the needle. They're always interested in the sort of big ticket media. You know, if ever a New York Times journalist comes to a bike race, that's seen as much more valuable than, again, not to pick on us or cycling news, but a cycling podcaster or a cycling news journalist. So, that's what they
Daniel,
want.
They're doing the equivalent of paying attention when the Masters is on, or paying attention when it's the Champions League final. Yeah. And that is the kind of natural order of it.
Yeah, but the problem is, in a sport with sort of nation states and oligarchs sponsoring teams, then how do you, if you're Picnic Post NL, how do you carve out a niche for yourself with, how do you create a story, a narrative around being the 20th best team in the world? And just sort of reflecting on this and reflecting on what happened with Remco and the teams, everything they're saying about creating narratives and stories. And this is all in the name of a sport which is becoming richer and richer, more and more elitist, and inordinate amounts, exorbitant amounts of money are being spent on shaving seconds off time trial times, and spending hundreds of thousands a year on sending riders to altitude, and it all seems to just feed towards that kind of elitism and the concentration of power and also media influence in the hands of a few, of the lucky few. And I don't think it's pointing in a very positive direction, personally.
But yeah, it's not very many weeks ago, Daniel, that you were pointing out that the viewing figure for Strade Bianche was the highest ever because of the Pog effect. And the Pog effect actually casts a big shadow across 16 of the World Tour teams, right? And so there's these two competing things as well. Just to mention Joe Laverick's piece of work, because it is a really good piece of work. And I think the most impressive thing about it was that he acknowledged quite prominently the balance between the private and the public, which I've talked about several times over the last couple of years. It's also touched on quite deeply in Alex Duff's book Le Fric, which is kind of about the business model of the Tour de France and cycling in general. The one thing that kind of gets lost in the whole conversation is that the sport itself is trying to privatize and profit. Corporations are advertising on events that are held on public roads at sometimes quite significant taxpayer cost and with an awful lot of political goodwill required just to make the events go ahead. And so there's also this kind of, I think that the teams kind of gatekeeping the message and kind of closing themselves off. And all of the talk about having a closed league and it's going to be an amazing business model and we're going to monetize the broadcasting and so on and so forth, it's not quite the same as saying, let's do that with the Champions League or whatever, where all of the clubs are playing in their own stadia and what have you. I know in American sport it's tricky because often the cities pay huge amounts of money for the stadia and there's probably quite an uneven relationship there. But in terms of cycling's kind of relationship with the public, I think the sport itself does sort of need to acknowledge that it is a sport that was born on public roads that we can all access. It takes over for the day or the 3 weeks of the major events, and then the stories kind of belong to the people who are interested, and that's a sort of really intangible thing that actually is really quite important for the sport.
It's just as important as the people lining up on the road.
Absolutely. And we've seen it that, you know, I know Alistair Fotheringham, our colleague who lives in Spain and has covered cycling for 35 years or whatever, you know, he always made the point that cycling's kind of popularity and boom in terms of roadside spectators come in times of economic hardship. The Vuelta's greatest days were when Spain's economy was, really suffering because it was free. People could go out and stand on the road. And so I'm not being sort of glib or flippant when I say that the stories belong to the fans, the public and what have you, but because from the team's point of view that is something that they could be a lot better at leveraging, and so I think that, you know, they, in to go back to the original example of the Remco reveal and the slight sense that really what it was about was trying to bypass the media, the team and the rider would have been smarter harnessing the media and actually recognizing that if they want to grow the base of this pyramid for business reasons, to promote the carbonated drink and the kitchens and showers, that there is a role for a mainstream media to play in that. And I think that is becoming a little bit uncoupled.
Oh, absolutely. I think you've nailed it, Lionel. It's absolutely becoming uncoupled. And I think that it's also because I almost think that it's a piece of laziness to it, but it's also a circumstance, you know, that would Remco really wanted to take out, let's say, 2 hours on his Thursday to be absolutely rampaged by media on the top of the Quadamont or at his hotel or whichever? It's certainly easy to persuade a rider not to do that if you're in his shoes.
There's ways and means, but also in this sort of relationship that Daniel was talking about, the next time a journalist makes an honest mistake or even a slightly sneaky mistake and prints or spreads a story that isn't true about Red Bull or Hansgrohe, they've kind of lost their moral high ground there, really. You know, it's a little bit, you can't on the one hand say, oh guys, you've got that completely wrong, when the team has, they denied to certain journalists, you know, flat out, didn't they, that Remco was going to ride the Tour of Flanders. And I think that's where the line sits. And
it's really unbecoming, you know.
Well, chaps, at least we didn't spend 45 minutes talking about ourselves. It is Tuesday, so I guess around 2 days before Remco Evenepoel's surprise announcement that he's also going to do Paris-Roubaix. Maybe wouldn't be such a surprise at this point because he's sort of teased it, but he's also said, I've done enough lying. Rest assured, we are going to stop talking about journalism and media. But one thing I forgot to mention, I think is worth mentioning, Hugo, who was calling, he told me he was calling Flanders Classics on Monday to demand, they told him what the Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe lineup was for Flanders. Hugo, who's retired, he pointed out to me that there has been a rule change since COVID. It was made for good reasons during the COVID period about when teams have to announce their lineups. And this sort of first alerted Hugo to maybe something that was brewing at Red Bull because, now, teams 72 hours before a race have to give a list. In the case of one-day World Tour races, 7 riders plus 3 reserves. But you can still change one of the 3 reserves up until 48 hours before the race. And Hugo's sort of antenna were already twitching when he saw Callum Thornley's name on the Red Bull list as a reserve. And Callum Thornley's a young rider who's not, you wouldn't expect him necessarily to be thrown into Paris-Roubaix. And Hugo already sort of smelt a rat there.
Text the journalist.
There you go. Lionel, you made this point a couple of weeks ago, and actually I've had this conversation with Matt Winston before a picnic post. And now there are teams and there are people in cycling who sort of say, well, why would we announce race programs until we are naming the team definitively? That doesn't happen in other sports. Why would we announce which riders are doing which grand tours in December? But that has become the norm in most teams to do precisely that, months in advance, in fact.
Just the last word there, Daniel. I mean, the team is entitled to pick whatever team they like within the rules and at whatever point. They could announce it in January if they want, or they can announce it right up at the last minute. I think the thing is that doing it, and especially as it fell on April Fool's Day, the kind of the whole ha-ha reveal, that's the point that irritated some of our colleagues. I'm speaking from the point of view of it's been a long, long time since I've had to do the kind of the team selection transfer news kind of beat. And it's not really something I'm terribly good at. It's not something I really enjoy. It's kind of where the cycling podcast meme of the sort of distaste for speculation comes from. My view is the start list is final when the riders are on the line. And I'm kind of less het up about whether or not Remco was going to ride or not, or, you know, it was a pleasant surprise, and it certainly worked out very well in the race. It added a really interesting dimension. But nevertheless, from a sort of journalist point of view, it would have been better to have been able to kind of anticipate this and discuss it and kind of ruminate on it. And I would suggest that the whole of sports popularity depends on those kind of barroom discussions. You want the cycling fans, who are the equivalent of me as a golf fan, paying half attention, sort of saying, oh, Remco's riding this year, what does that mean? And I think there's pros and cons to it, but I think it didn't achieve the result that perhaps they were setting out to achieve. But let's move on. We have got a race coming up.
Having just reaffirmed your distaste for speculation, let's indulge in some speculation, shall we, about Paris-Roubaix.
Is Remco riding Paris-Roubaix?
Well, Pogacar, as far as we know, is definitely racing Paris-Roubaix, although he's currently back home on the Côte d'Azur, training as we speak. And of course, this will be billed as a big rematch between him and Van der Poel, with some illustrious walk-on extras as well. Your compatriot Mads Pedersen will be one, Brian, although I've seen him admit in the press in the last couple of days that he's not feeling quite himself, which is maybe unsurprising given that he's still coming back from injury. Another man coming back from injury, which we've talked about a lot, is Wout van Aert, who I think would admit that he's feeling pretty good and is pretty happy with the way the spring has gone so far. It's just that there happen to be, in particular, 2 riders that have been stronger than him so far. But, chaps, how much of the cars going to be reshuffled for Sunday? Obviously, a very different race, but it didn't really give us a very different hierarchy or outcome last time around.
Last year, I was really thinking that Roubaix will be a completely different beast because, obviously, no real climbing. And it's a race where the final starts way earlier. But then when you saw Molenberg Flanders opening Molenbeek, which is placed more or less at the exact number of kilometers as the Arnberg Forest is, which is around about 100 kilometers before the finish. You sort of already know that that major selection will force an elite group to fight it out amongst each other. And what used to be a numbers game in Paris-Roubaix could also be that again, but I think it will evaporate quite early and will have a very similar situation to what we had on last Sunday. It will be the elite racing against the elite. I just think that the possibility of Pogacar doing what he did, you know, his tactic in Flanders is pretty obvious. He'll make it as hard as possible because he knows that that wears off easier on him than it does on his competitors. They'll just crumble, whereas he'll still be standing up. But I think that the possibility for riders, especially riders like Van Aert and Mads Pedersen, they'll last longer in Roubaix than they'll do in Flanders. I don't see him being able to ride them out of his wheel as easy in Roubaix as he did in Flanders. I'm not saying that they'll hang on all the way onto necessarily Carrefour-Labre. You know, it's usually the case, isn't it, that it's selection in the forest of Arnberg, and then the race gets decided no later than the Carrefour-Labre. I just have a different feeling about how exciting a race is going to be. It's a way bigger potential for redemption for Van der Poel, because his spring, as I'm looking at monuments, has been a huge disappointment if he doesn't walk away with a win on Sunday. And Mads Pedersen, I mean, just the fact that he's racing now, everything considered, is almost a miracle. Whereas I always feel that Van Aert really shines in Roubaix when he's good. He's just been really unlucky also, right? So I think we have a better possibility for an even grander race on Sunday than we did in Flanders.
Of course, there's one other rider I should mention, which is Filippo Ganna.
We'll come on to that, because if there's one thing that's even more pointless than transfer speculation or team lineup speculation, it's the weather forecast. We're too far out, really, for it to be accurate, but it could be drizzly on Saturday and Sunday. If it's drizzly and the cobbles are wet and there's mud, that makes it a very different race. I think that tilts it more in favour of Van der Poel. Remember last year, of course, the pair of them got away, Van der Poel and Pogacar, and we were really anticipating this grandstand finish in the last hour, weren't we? Or last 45 minutes, I guess. And then with around, what was it, 40K to go, Pogacar kind of missed the corner and went down. And that denied us the head-to-head that we'd really been anticipating. So in a way, I hope we get that head-to-head this Sunday and we see whether Pogacar can win. There's so much at stake for him, isn't there? Because it would complete a consecutive run of all of the monuments, wouldn't it? He would be the holder of all the monuments if he wins on Sunday. Van der Poel is going for a record of his own. He's won three in a row, the same as Octave Lapiz in 1909 to 1911 and Francesco Moser in 1978 to 1980. Van der Poel could become the first rider to win four in a row, which would also equal the record of Roger de Vlaeminck and Tom Bonin as four-time Paris-Roubaix winners. There's so much at stake. Everyone's anticipating the big two and then the rest. I think, as you said, Brian, the rest have got more of a chance here than they had in Flanders on Sunday, just because of the nature of the course and the fact that luck plays a bigger role. You know, punctures, especially if the weather's bad, you know, it's much less predictable. And I think that's why it's going to be appointment viewing from really the start to the finish.
Take Mads Pedersen, who's obviously conditioned because of his preparations have been nowhere near what he had hoped for, but he would have been he finished third and that might have been the end of it anyways last year, but he punctured just as everything happened last year and he waited a minute for a bike change. Those things you can never really rule out, and you couldn't rule them out for anyone, including Pogacar, but it's just this: if you're really strong, you cope better with whatever the race throws at you. And we just never, Van der Poel's never really been unlucky in a heartbreaking way in Roubaix, has he?
No, I mean, he had his puncture near the end, didn't he? But the race was already in the bag by that stage.
I think in our speculation episode at the start of the year, I suggested, not wanting to tempt fate, but I suggested that Mathieu van der Poel had diced with disaster a few too many times. And these make for, going back to our prior discussion about social media, these make for great sort of memeable moments. But I feel as though at some point, if he's not careful, he's going to come a cropper. And he does take a lot of risk, particularly at Paris-Roubaix. You know, a lot of riding on the grass and in the gutter. That's something maybe to keep our eye on.
He'll be all right until he cuts his mullet, and then it'll all go wrong.
Also, in our speculation episode at the start of the year, I predicted that Matthew Brennan would win Paris-Roubaix. I was expecting Matthew Brennan to have a similar start to the season as Paul Sexas, similarly precocious after the season he had last year, but things have not really panned out for Brennan so far. He's had some issues, illness and so on, but he will probably be riding, but no one really will have him amongst their favourites. Just one final thing on Pogacar and his team, just looking at, and we don't have the lineups yet, but thinking about the team that they might field at the weekend, they're pretty well equipped, maybe better equipped than they were even at the Tour of Flanders with the likes of Florent Vermeersch in particular. I mean, he's shown a lot of pedigree in Paris-Roubaix in the last couple of years. I expect Johansson to be pretty good, Jonas Johansson, Brian. I mean, obviously not at the back end of the race, but the sort of team he has for the first 100 kilometres, 150 kilometres or so, looks pretty well stocked. So, it should be very interesting.
It's a different race altogether. I mean, I know that we're used to finals being way more exclusive at an earlier point. But just the thing with Roubaix is that it is almost every man for himself, or every man and one next to him after the Forest. That's just how cruel that race has become. And if you add the horsepower of the big riders, just the fact that if they're able to collaborate after the Arnberg Forest, we could have the similar situation that we had in a similar type of group after Molenberg in Roubaix this year. It could be a bit of a drama very, very early on with the big riders.
Of course, Ganna has had a week off. He spent Easter Sunday on the couch watching the race, probably stuffing his face with chocolate eggs.
Carbo loading a week out.
Yeah, I mean, we touched on his performance at Dwars Door of Vlaanderen, didn't we, Daniel, in our Arrivé episode? But, you know, he had the broken handlebars at a really critical point in the race and then got back in and then finished it off in pretty impressive fashion, you know, broke Wout van Aert's heart in the process. Clearly going well. You know, he's been sixth before, and I think he'll be a factor. Whether the freshness will help him, potentially, but it's a race where so many of these top riders have got very, very consistent results. I mean, Mads Pedersen's been fourth, third and third in the last three attempts. Van Aert has been seventh, second, third and fourth in the last four attempts. It's a race where you could probably look at the last two or three years and come up with a very close top 10 before it starts. And I think the weather, the wind direction, whether it's wet, that will be the thing that kind of shapes how the race goes. And as you say, Brian, the likelihood of all of the favourites getting away in one is much reduced at Paris-Roubaix. I think the gaps would, you know, be more unpredictable. And the thing that shaped that whole finale of the Tour of Flanders after Molenberg was that no one really missed it. Whereas I think in Paris-Roubaix, something will happen. There'll be somebody out of position. And it could be a real humdinger. I've been saying that a lot this spring, but the racing has been really, really good, and there's no reason to suspect it won't be on Sunday.
Indeed, indeed. Well, we'll be back on Sunday. Lionel, if I must get back from the Basque Country in time, I think I'm due to land mid-afternoon, so I might have to catch up. I might have to catch up on the first bits of Paris-Roubaix. Anyway,
are we going to have a YouTube reveal with Brian on Saturday night?
Maybe,
he's been
possibly
drafted in for Paris-Roubaix.
Possibly. So on Sunday we will have Arrivé. There'll be a women's Arrivé as well this weekend, and we'll be back next week. I'll be reporting back in some form from Itzulia, and we will be then looking forward to a different kind of classic, which of course starts with Amstel Gold a week on Sunday.
Just a quick mention of a couple of things for friends of the podcast. 10 years ago, Matt Heyman won the race, having fractured his collarbone in a crash in Omloop only 6 weeks before, and then pretty much did all of his training on the indoor trainer, came back and won Paris-Roubaix, his first race back, I think it was. And Richard Moore made a great episode, went and spoke to Matt Heyman about how that whole period went and how the race unfolded. I've just bumped that episode up to the top of the feed, so if people want to get some cobbled fever before Sunday, that's there to listen to now, as is the latest installment in my kind of quasi travel log, travel guide to the Spring Classics. A spectator's guide to Paris-Roubaix is available for friends of the podcast. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com.
Excellent. We'll be back on Sunday.
Thanks, Daniel. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you, Lionel. Thank you, Brian.
Cheers, guys.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.